So this is John Rivette at Pauline Adams' house on Sunday.
What are you doing?
I'm just taping everything, and I'll tell you why. At any point, if you say something you want stopped, I'll press pause and we won't put it on the tape. But that's why I said I was going to make you mad. Did it work?
Pause.
Caught you by surprise. You're not the first person I've done that to recently.
You like to do that to people.
Well, it's not that I like to be rude. I mean, but what we're going to talk about, if you don't, I mean, I don't mind talking about anything you want to talk about. We could talk about yesterday's development hoopla, and if you had any fun or not, and what the Rivettes thought about it, or Luanna's article in the paper today, or whatever.
No, I didn't but see her article in the paper today.
About her, front page of the State Journal.
No.
But what I wanted to talk about, and I brought a release form in my interview protocol, just to let you have those, and we'll get your signature. And I brought my little iPad device so we could schedule an interview, because that's what I called you about, was just to say, when do you want to meet?
See, I couldn't. I have difficulty hearing. That's why I retired from teaching this year.
And so do I. But I, anyways.
And the phone makes it.
I didn't mind at all. I live close, and it wasn't a problem to come. You were eating, and I was.
But I didn't realize you wanted to.
Well, here's what I want to talk to you about, okay? And I'll tell you, and we don't have to do any of the interviewing tonight. I can be gone in 5 minutes. That's
okay.
Not a problem. So one is a personal thing. First, you wrote a populist assault, Sarah E. Vandevort Emery on American Democracy, 1862-95. With a co-author, Emma Thornton, back a few years ago, 82.
I've forgotten everything about the book.
I'm not going to ask you about any details about the book. It has a nice acknowledgments and preface that explains why you and this gal who I don't know at all, this Emma Thornton, wrote the book. I have two copies of it, one a paperback, which inside it says, Happy St. Pat's Day 83, love, O Papa, or a Papa. I gave it to my wife as a gift.
Oh.
And then I have one that you signed over to my younger daughter, Catherine.
Oh.
When I think you came to her graduation reception at our house.
Oh.
In June of 2002.
And when was it published? When was
82, it says.
82,
so
that was 20 years after the publication when
okay.
I gave you them.
And so I need to pass that on to Katie. Somehow I have two, and I want to get my own autographed copy from you later. I don't want it right now, but I'm going to leave it here and ask you to autograph it later. So that was one. Tough.
That I can do that.
Very good. Here was the things that I wanted to talk to you about. So you may or may not remember, and I didn't bring the date with me, but I interviewed Walter out on your patio.
Yeah, I don't remember.
Years ago. We moved in 91, so it's after that. But exactly when between 91 and the year Walter passed, I don't know.
Yeah, he died in 98.
Okay, so somewhere between 91 and 98.
Yeah.
I don't know if you knew that he and I knew each other a little, not because of his time in the Center of Labor-Industrial Relations, which is one of the things I want to talk to you about.
I don't think he was ever associated with
it. I didn't think so either, but I'll get the interview tape. I mean, nobody believes me, but in fact, Bill Fonts was associated with the center. He had a joint appointment, sociology, which most people know about because he became the chair of sociology department.
Right.
But at the beginning of the LIR Center, when Killingsworth, your neighbor just across the street,
whom we were very close friends with,
Killingsworth was the original director of this new center.
Right.
And he had a joint appointment.
in economics.
Correct.
He was chairman of economics.
Correct. Jack Stieber.
Yes, who followed him.
Followed him as director, but he preceded, he was hired by Chuck, Charles Killingsworth, to be his research director.
That I didn't know.
And he had a joint appointment.
In economics.
In economics.
Right, I knew that.
I interviewed Lance LaRue.
Right.
Who lived not too far away.
He had a joint appointment.
He had a joint appointment.
Right, because they were all labor economists.
Right, and so he had a joint appointment, economics and labor industrial relations. I got to know Lash because he asked me to come give an annual guest lecture about some labor history thing, probably Michigan labor history.
Yeah, wouldn't be surprised.
Besides, he was one of the people who used to go to the swimming pool at lunchtime.
Well, there you are.
I believe that's where I mostly met Walter, was hanging around at the men's IM.
Did Walter go swimming? No.
No.
He played...
racquetball.
Racquetball, right.
But he was there.
Yeah.
Lash didn't actually swim either.
Oh, he didn't?
I don't think so.
I wouldn't be surprised.
My recollection is that Lash played paddleball or something.
Maybe.
But he hung around, and of course Lash was this public character. And he did a famous thing, which something named like the cocoa butter tanning contest he would hold at the pool.
Sounds like him, but...
whatever.
Yeah, but I wasn't...
My point is, at that point, it's still the boys and girls are segregated in the pool, but they did have in the locker rooms... a faculty staff locker room separate from the regular locker room.
I see.
And some of these guys were all in the faculty staff. And when I first went, you may remember one of my mentors who was in the, after the center turns into the School of Labor Industrial Relations, Bob Ripas.
Oh, yes.
Was one of the original labor educators. Bob and I would go swimming at lunchtime.
I see.
So Bob and I would walk over. There was a whole routine. Bob had diabetes.
Didn't know that.
And he would want to eat before we went swimming. I'd rather eat after I went swimming. Maybe my mom taught me to do it that way. I don't know.
Yeah, because we were always taught you don't go swimming for an hour at least after you ate.
But anyway, so Ripas and I would go around 12:15 to the pool. One of the days a week, he played volleyball.
Oh.
And there were some of these faculty staff that played volleyball. Some played paddleball. Some just hung out. Some were swimmers. Now, one of the profs, nothing to do with labor relations, but I got to know quite well, was Milton Mulder.
Oh, yes, of course.
He just passed away a couple of years ago.
That's right. His birthday is the same day as Walter's.
I didn't know that.
Yes. August 27th.
Well, Milton kept swimming until I think he was 100, or almost.
Well, he died at about 100.
101 or something. He wasn't really swimming at the end, and they had a device to put him in the water. But it was very sweet, because...
And he really, yes, he kept his routine to the very end.
And I used to love talking with him in the locker room about what he and his wife had given money through MSU development for the Mulder Gardens, the Japanese gardens.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a bit of a gardener, so I enjoyed talking to him about that. He just knew MSU history. So I had great fun around that. So I think I met Walter there, but I'm not positive. But I do recall interviewing him, and I'll find the tape. And I think the interview I recall is out here, although I also know I went to his office in economics several times. And he had a hilarious office. It was big, filled and stuffed with things. And as I'm sure you knew, he lit up a cigar as soon as the door was closed.
Well, he didn't even close the door, did he? I'm surprised if he did, yeah.
Maybe I'm just making that up. But he was one of the few profs that smoked a cigar. It was pretty funny. Anyways, he was very enjoyable, and I liked talking to him. He told me some stories, and at one point I wanted to ask, I just hear your side of those stories. And so those were some of them.
If I know any of them.
Well, just what you thought, what it was like when you moved to these faculty bricks and the, what'd you call the apartments?
The Cherry Lane.
Okay. And you guys moved there?
We call them brick apartments. And right by your chair, to the your left, is a brick from the apartment we lived in.
I see it. Okay. So at that time, were they separated, the bricks from the Cherry Lane? Or you didn't really think of them as two things? It was just one set of apartments?
It was the brick apartments at Cherry Lane.
Okay.
Each one was named, each apartment building was named after an MSU alum who died in World War II. I'm ashamed to say I never remembered the name of the person. All I know is that I lived at 801 Cherry Lane.
What year did you move in there, do you think?
1947. We were the first tenants in the building. And they had just been constructed.
And you came from where?
Well, I came originally from New York City.
Brooklyn or?
Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
But Walter came back from the military, from the war, in 1945. He was fortunate enough to be one of the, because he had enough points. See, they sent the priority for returning from the European theater and the Pacific theater was the number of points you had accumulated.
What'd you get points for?
The points were allocated on by how long you served, where you served, what battles you were in, you know. And he had accumulated enough points. So he was able to get back on one of the earlier trips returning from Europe. He was in Europe. And he came back at the end of, I don't know the exact date, but it was the end of August or early September. He had, before he went into the Army, he had two quarters of graduate study at the University of Chicago. And then he was drafted. When he came back, he decided that instead of going back to the University of Chicago, because we were already married.
You got married before the war?
No, we got married during the war.
Okay.
In 43.
Okay.
When he was already in the Army.
Okay.
And I had made a commitment. I didn't know when he was coming back to teach in the New York City high school system for the fall semester in 45. So he decided instead of going all the way to Chicago, that he took his parents' car and went up the coastline. And to say, his requirement was the first university that hadn't started its semester yet, who would accept him as a graduate student, that would give him credit for the two quarters that he had taken at the University of Chicago, he would go to. And the first one that fulfilled all those requirements was Yale University.
Okay.
And so he went to Yale. And he got his degree in 2 years. He worked very, very hard, got his degree in 2 years. And he taught while he was there. You know, he was a
grad assistant, sort of?
He taught a class.
They didn't use that term.
And then, and his job, when he graduated in 47, he had two job offers. One was Michigan State College, and the other was LSU, Louisiana State University. Well, there was no way we would go south, which was notoriously segregated still at that time.
Is that the reason why? It wasn't the heat, it was segregation. It wasn't the heat, it was the segregation.
Was the segregation, yeah. No, we wouldn't live in a southern culture. So we took Michigan State College, and when Walter told his fellow graduate students, well, we got a job at Michigan State College, and they said, oh, you like Ann Arbor. They had never heard.
Right.
Yeah, they just knew of Michigan.
Mm-hmm. Well, I recall.
And that's when we came.
And did you have children yet?
had an infant. Jim was 5 months old when we moved here.
And then you had how many other kids?
No others. I have only one child.
One of the stories I recall from interviewing him, and I didn't listen to the tape before coming because I just came to find out when we could meet to talk, was he talked about looking out your backyard and the kind of contrast between this and Brooklyn.
Yes, big contrast.
What was that?
Well, I mean, first of all, although my house in Brooklyn had a yard, but the yard was not as large as my front yard. I mean, it was just a tiny bit of land. And here we have a nice lot. And behind was the farmer was still farming when we built this house. And he had cows back there, so we would see the cows right in our backyard, practically, which was very exciting.
You liked that?
I loved it.
I'll have to listen to the tape again. I don't remember Walter being delighted by that.
Well, he was more of an urban person, I guess, than I was.
Okay.
But he really grew to like it very much. He was not a gardener, but he enjoyed sawing the wood in back for the fireplace.
Uh-huh.
Because we had along the lot line, it was the only place where there were trees. You know, there's only, you know enough about the history of Lantern Hill, that there was only one, there was a line right by our lot line here to the south where there was a fencing. And there were tree seedlings, wild seedlings that grew up along that fencing. Otherwise, it was a mud flat. That's what this whole area was.
Run with cows, or were they growing crops?
Well, they had fields for the cows, and they didn't. It was all cleared land.
Were they growing corn or anything, or just
not
do you recall?
Not this area, right where we are. So that this was the only place. So we had old trees that were seedlings that grew up along the barbed wire fence that had run right down that line. And we had a lot of fallen limbs, and Walter would be out sawing them on the patio to fit into the fireplace.
Uh-huh.
And I always realized that when I watched him sawing, etc., that what he was doing was writing the first draft of a book in his mind.
Mm-hmm.
And that I realized. So he acclimated to a more
rural
life in that respect.
Had you or he ever related to Cornell University and it being a land grant before you came here?
No.
Okay.
We would never read. No.
You found out later that MSU was kind of a Cornell.
Well, about the land grant whole tradition.
Right. Yeah. Well, interesting.
But we both went to Brooklyn College, which was a city college. And
was that free tuition then, or?
Well,
or inexpensive.
We had to pay a 50-cent registration fee and a 50-cent library fee each term.
It's close to free.
Otherwise, it was free.
What address did you or he live on before you?
Pardon?
What address in Brooklyn or what neighborhoods in Brooklyn are
I
you
lived
from?
I in Bensonhurst.
Okay.
Do you know Brooklyn at all?
Our younger daughter, Catherine, the one the book you autographed, lived there for 3 years. She worked.
Where did she live? She didn't live in Bensonhurst, I'm sure.
No, she worked just down the street from the Empire State Building.
Oh,
but
in
when
Manhattan.
But she never lived there. She worked there for a British firm. She lived at first in Queens, and I'm thinking Astoria. Is that somewhere?
Astoria's in Queens.
And an easy train ride into work.
Yes.
I can't remember if there was a second Queens or not, but then she moved to Brooklyn. For a while, she lived in Prospect Park in a rather upscale with her boyfriend.
Right. Park Slope, right.
But then she was someplace kind of northwest of that, and I'd have to, northwest of the park, and I can't remember the name of that neighborhood. It was something not sort of in the process of gentrifying now.
Yeah.
And it would come to me. But that's where Kate lived.
Yeah.
She'd gone to grad school at DePaul, and liked Chicago, and the firm she works for is a British firm called Flash Talking, based in Leeds, England. They do pop-up ads. They have a large office in Leeds and London, a few other European ones. New York is their biggest U.S. one, but they have smaller ones in Chicago and San Francisco. And so she kind of convinced them it would be good to have her go back to Chicago, work back for her. So she's back in Chicago now.
Yeah, so she's happy there.
Yeah, and her parents like it because we can see her much easier.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
She can come visit us, we can go see her.
Oh, I know.
And we like Chicago a lot.
Yeah, well, Chicago seems to be a nice city. I don't know it well, but my two grandsons went to Northwestern, which is on the periphery.
Is that Jim, you said, was your son's name?
My son is Jim.
Uh-huh.
And his two sons went to Northwestern. Jim went to Harvard, but his two sons went to Northwestern.
What are their names? What are the grandsons' names?
My grandsons are Matthew and Zachary.
Where do they live now?
They both live in California, but Matthew lives in San Francisco and Zachary lives in San Diego.
50-ish?
My grandsons?
Mm-hmm.
My grandsons are in their 30s.
30s. Oh, I'm sorry, yes.
Yeah, my son is in his
60s.
60s.
Mm-hmm. He's probably close to me. I'm 64.
He's 67.
Now
he was born in 47.
Now he's born in 50.
And so he's 3 years older than you.
Now, is he an economist?
He's a professor of economics at the U of M.
Okay. Had he been in Texas for a while, though?
No.
You guys used to go to Texas just because Walter had a gig in Trinity for the winter semester, is that? Something.
Walter was a visiting distinguished professor for the spring semester at Trinity for 8 or 9 years after he retired from Michigan State.
Did you go with him for that time?
Oh, yes, I was.
I thought so.
Yeah. So we spent the winter semesters down there.
Did you rent this house out or just leave it?
No, we just left it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I didn't rent it. So we were only gone for
3 months?
About 4 months.
Did you like it?
Oh, yes, it was wonderful.
In what city is it in?
It's in San Antonio.
Okay.
Yeah, it was a wonderful experience.
Nice. So the heat's fine. You don't mind being in the heat.
Okay.
I'm just curious. So I wanted to ask you about that, but you kind of covered it. Anything else you want to tell me about Lantern Hill and how the group of...
Well, you know the story of Lantern Hill.
But not... Have you told somebody on tape? That's my question.
I may have.
Okay.
I don't know.
You did do
some... may very well have.
Okay.
I just don't remember. I know I was interviewed quite a number of years ago. Can't think of Zai's name. He was in my department.
In American Thought and Language. Was this part of the Sesquicentennial Project?
May have been.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I think it is. I didn't do the background I should have because I wasn't coming to interview you, but to set up a meeting.
Yeah.
But I've started learning that if I don't put the tape on, you or I will say something, and then if we meet again, we'll go, well, as we said last time. And like, well, that wasn't taped, so what's that?
So yeah, it's no good.
But it's kind of, it's funny. I mean, it's a little rude, but just a couple other quick things. Because I do think we could just set up. On those interviews, did you talk about his year as president? From your perspective?
Not really. I have no memory of that interview that I gave quite a few years
ago. Okay.
I was interviewed not for an oral history project, but on this program that Mark Bayshaw has called whatever.
Right.
I forgot what it's called. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I was interviewed on that last year.
Okay.
Last year.
And do you think you talked about Walter's year as president and your perspective? I'll tell you what.
Not much. I'm trying to think. Rather the early years when we first came.
Okay.
And what East Lansing was like then, that kind of thing.
Okay, so I won't talk about that. And I'll get back to the other. So one of my things right now is I've retired 18 months ago. And I had a few.
I went to your retirement, so I know.
I'm taping it, so the tape didn't know it, but you're right. It was quite a hoopla because it was first Stan Soffen retiring as the ombudsman,
right,
which Carolyn Stieber had been in
right.
prior, and your long-term friend of hers.
Yes.
And it was for me as FGO, and it was a lot of people, you know.
I remember.
Maybe 200, a lot of people.
Oh, a lot. It was
a big tent room. And it was great fun.
It was quite an event.
The only thing I had at all negative is I got to be last, and people wanted to leave.
And I
had a lot of jokes and a lot of things I wanted to say, and I had to cut it short.
Yeah.
But it was okay. And you know, it was very touching. I mean, there were a lot of people that
it was
a
wonderful.
It was a very nice event, and Terry Curry as the associate provost was very thoughtful in doing this. Anyways, I then retired from that, and of course, I don't know how much you know about how I came and went as FGO, because the first
I don't know anything about that.
Okay, well. There are some people in the Voice Library, the Vincent Voice Library, and of course you knew Dr. Crane well.
Not well, but I knew him for a long time. When he first came, I met him.
Right, and he worked in making this Voice Library even better. And now his assistant from the old days, John Shaw.
Whom I know just by working through him for the Oral History Project of the FEA.
And you and I had some interaction about this faculty alum. What do you call it again? The
Faculty Emeriti Association.
FEA. And we met and chatted about doing oral history interviews.
You gave me, and there were a couple of other guys from the steering committee, a little seminar on how to conduct these oral history, and you gave us a lot of material to read, and I started doing it, and it ended up I was the only one practically doing it. The others, and I don't know why, the library is very helpful in setting up the room and everything else, so I didn't have to do anything except prepare for the interview.
And
so I've done about 13 or 14 of them.
And John Shaw is very thankful for you doing that. And he would like you to interview me, which when I when I told Diane that, she laughed. But I have sort of recommitted to trying to get back doing more oral history interviews on what I call my bucket list of topics that I want to be able to give presentations and or write papers about. And so one of them is about the grievance procedure, because it's a rather unique one. One is about the Center of Labor Industrial Relations and its labor outreach to the union leadership. And
right.
That's my first deadline, because I'm giving a paper in Orlando on the 25th of March.
Oh, that's coming up very quickly.
Yes, it is. And so I'm going to be focusing mostly on questions about that. And I don't think you probably have a lot to tell me about the beginning of the LIR Center or the Labor Extension.
No. Walter and I really, when I think of it now, we live parallel lives. He was with, and I was working, I was teaching. And so we were each busy with our own work. I know it doesn't make sense. Even when he was in the presidency, I was busy teaching. I taught the whole time.
And that was one of the things I wanted to find out. And it doesn't have to be tonight at all, but your work teaching in AT&L, your work teaching in evening college, have you talked to other interviewers about those topics? Because I know just in the last decade or two that I've known you, we sometimes would chat about what are you teaching this fall, what are you teaching? Partly because I was thinking of doing some myself.
Yeah.
But
part... It was wonderful. It's too late now because the evening college is...
But one of the things I'm working on right now is to figure out some places to teach. And when I finished the grievance job, and there was a difficult transition because the first person who was going to take over only lasted 2 months.
You're kidding.
No, I'm not. And so I came back for 8 months more, whatever.
I didn't realize.
Most
that.
People didn't because we kept it quiet. But I went from being FGO to FGO Emeritus to interim FGO to then FGO Emeritus again. But we did it quietly to not embarrass the person who...
What happened?
Linda Jackson was selected. Linda Jackson from psychology. She recently passed away. But
I don't know.
She was a psychologist. She was a good researcher. Somehow, mostly appropriately, but a little funny, I was not involved at all in the process of selecting a replacement. I had had my 5-year review. Kim Wilcox was the provost. Before my 5-year review, we had revised the grievance procedure and some significant... Some...
Did he come to you to grieve when he was...
No.
He had all his problems.
And administrators can't... Administrators' faculty life is grievable. But your position as an administrator is clearly not. It's an at-will situation.
I see.
And so it is. I had administrators come and talk to me about it, and I would have to say, you really can't grieve this. You can think about suing them or whatever.
Right.
But it isn't grievable under the grievance procedure. And quite frankly, I knew that Kim and Luanna weren't getting along. Because as grievance official, I was on the fourth floor enough to know what was going on. On the other hand, I was absolutely in shock because when he did leave, because I had been up there some point in the middle of December meeting with Curry as associate provost, he'd replace Banks, of course, or meeting somebody else up there. And Kim was a laugher. I mean, he was pretty funny in terms of his laughter on the hallway.
Yes, he was known for his laugh.
Right. So you'd know when he was there, usually. And then I went back a week or 10 days later, and he was gone. And nobody would talk about it appropriately. But it was strange because I had not been that long since I'd been up there. And he was gone, completely gone. And then a little later... It appeared in the paper that he was getting a special opportunity to go do something else for a while.
Of his story.
Which kind of is also was kind of happened with Peter McPherson, who, when I first became the FGO, Luanna was provost and Peter was president.
Right.
And how I was interviewed by Peter at a box at a basketball game was more than ridiculous. I'd already gone through... And I think Bob Banks was getting frustrated because I was getting to the point of I don't think I want this job. It had gone on way too long. And I'd been approved by the UCFA committee, clearly by Banks.
Well, you knew that LaRue was...
Right. I've interviewed all the FGOs that were alive a couple of years ago.
Yes.
Last earlier than the others. But anyways, so I knew some of those kind of stories. And Bruce Miller and I got kind of close because there was a series of years, most of Rubner's years, where it almost was a joke that it was Miller versus Rivette and whoever they were bringing today. Because Bruce was available and willing to represent whoever administrator needed assistance, and Rivette was pretty willing and able to do for faculty members. And so Bruce and I got to know each other a lot because we were in the room a lot.
And it was Bruce who made the stand for that brick. Because, you know, he's a woodworker.
His career
and
after retiring was hilarious.
He made the stand for that brick.
He's a great guy. So I interviewed Bruce. I interviewed Lash. I interviewed Michael Rubner. He came up here for a reason. Mary Lee Brady did not have a great successful career. Mary Lee Brady was the FGO for a while in the 80s before Rubner. I interviewed her by telephone. Michael Harrison was the first FGO. Most people don't know it because he was there a year.
Yeah.
And the most funny thing about him was one of the first grievances he got was from Bob Ripas, who grieved that he wasn't selected as the first FGO. So I interviewed Harrison about that.
He isn't too well, I think.
Oh, that's too bad. He's a nice man.
Yeah.
And I guess he was Lyman Briggs' first
director,
whatever the title was.
The dean of Lyman Briggs, yes.
But, so I'm probably missing somebody else I interviewed. But anyways, that's one of the pots, and that pot about the history of the grievance procedure and how it works is something that Dr. Banks and I are working on because it's rather unique. Most universities that the faculty aren't unionized don't have anything that elaborate. And so Bob Banks and I would like to figure out to what extent other labor relations people in higher ed would be interested in hearing about it. So so that's one of these kind of pots that I'm interested in.
That should be very interesting.
Right.
Yeah.
Another one that Banks and I and Curry are interested in is the story in terms of who is and who isn't unionized among faculty, both the tenure stream and then these fixed term or adjuncts, and what impact that has on how the place operates. And as you know, there were three attempts to unionize the MSU faculty, and I don't know if you know any about that, or that was just Walter's world, not yours.
No, it was mainly Walter's world. We did belong to the AAUP.
Okay.
And you know he was national president of the AAUP.
And I don't think when Walter and I talked in your patio, and in the interview day that we taped that, whether or not, I think he had told me, because he and Coletta and several other people I knew were part of the AUP group, whereas Gladys Beckwith and Dorothy McMeekin and Phil Korth and Bob Ripas were part of the MEA Faculty Associates group.
I always got a kick out of the fact, I don't know why, and I find it amusing, that he became national president of the AAUP after he was president of Michigan State. And I just got a kick out of
that.
It
is funny.
I thought it was a funny coincidence.
Did he stay AAUP for much time after, or just for...
No, I don't know how long his term of office was. I was really not part of that at all.
Mm-hmm.
I often went, when he went to economics conferences and conventions, I would often go with him. I never went to any of the AUP stuff, and so I really don't know that aspect at all.
I know, similarly, it's now called Labor and Employment Relations Association, or LERA. It had been called IRRA. Industrial Relations Research Association, and I used to go to that, and that was something that both Killingsworth and Stieber were presidents of and active, and Carolyn Stieber often went to
with Jack
to those IRA, then LERA ones.
And I think they did arbitration, both Jack and
Carolyn. There was something called SPIDER or something, Society for Professionals in Dispute Resolution, which because of her work in...
she may have done that, I don't know.
Yeah, because of her work as the ombudsman.
Yeah. But I know that Killingsworth did outside arbitration.
Oh, so did Stieber.
And I think Stieber did too.
Rich Block in my generation.
Yeah.
Ben Wilkinson.
Yeah.
All were arbitrators. So I had actually thought about doing it as a retirement thing, but Rich and other arbitrators, I know, were all saying because of the decline in the unions in the state, that there's less business.
I'm sure. I don't know. Yeah. But it's a terrible decline.
It's still quite hard to believe Michigan's a right-to-work state now. Because you wouldn't have guessed it.
I know.
And, you know, New York State has not gone as conservative as Michigan, nor as New Jersey.
Michigan, it's amazing the decline in the state in all its public services and everything else.
So I wanted to chat with you about those couple things. I think we did a lot of it right now.
Yeah, and I'm not sure I can be of much help. That's what I'm saying.
I should find these interviews that you did before and double check to see what other things.
Yeah, and I have no idea what was said. I don't even...
Briefly, what is it you taught for AT&L? In what years? And what was
from 1956, and I retired in 1992.
Okay. And what was your title and status?
I started out as a temporary. They'd hire me every quarter, and of course that meant I didn't get Social Security, I didn't get, you know, any payment or anything. And then they finally put me in the tenure track after about 12 years of this.
Okay.
I don't remember exactly anymore.
Before Walter was president?
Before Walter was president.
Uh-huh.
Then they promoted me from an instructor to assistant professor,
uh-huh.
Then to associate professor.
Mm-hmm.
And my last year of teaching, when I was retiring at age 70, the department put me up for a promotion to full professorship, knowing I was retiring.
Mm-hmm.
And the dean of the college refused to go along.
What year was this? What dean?
I know. I'm trying to... do you know the dean, whoever the dean was of Arts and Letters?
Well, I knew all of them during the years as grievance official. I don't know all of them before.
All right. But name some of them and I'll pick it out.
Lady or man?
Man.
John Eady?
Eady.
E-A-D-I-E?
Yeah, I think it was Eady. Did he come from Michigan?
I think that may be true.
Yeah. I think it was Eady.
I think that's probably right.
And I must say, I thought it was amusing that he would refuse to give that promotion because it was meaningless to me.
Mm-hmm.
But Walter never forgave him.
Yeah, I wouldn't have.
He was furious. I said, "What are you? It's meaningless to me."
It was an affront.
Whether they call me a full professor, I'm retiring, and anyhow, you know, it just didn't.
It was an affront.
He said it wasn't fair.
Now, I assume Eady did it because she didn't have a PhD, is that?
Maybe. Whatever his reason, I don't know.
Yeah.
But whatever it was, I thought it was funny.
Yeah. Who was the department chair at that point?
Good question.
Was it Nover? Before Doug Nover.
It was...
Doug Nover?
No, it was before.
Before Nover.
Before Doug Nover, yeah.
Female.
Yeah, it may have been, it wasn't Silverman. I don't remember.
That doesn't matter.
I'm ashamed to say.
It doesn't matter at all. I was curious if it was.
I don't remember, but I know that I had the full support of my department for the promotion.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's just, to me, it's very amusing.
Yeah.
Walter was so angry. I would have been.
I
think it's crazy. But what difference does it make? The important.
I just was rude. It was just rude. It was unnecessary
and
rude.
My relationship to my students was the important thing to me.
So what did you teach in the department?
American thought and language. You know what the university college was.
Somewhat. But
yeah. And the course, which was a requirement of all students, was a combination of a course in writing and American culture.
Mm-hmm.
And by American culture, they meant not only history, but the literary history as well as the political history.
Which is what you taught later for Evening College, right? You
no.
Taught, no?
No.
Oh, I thought you taught culture and books.
In college, I taught contemporary fiction.
Contemporary fiction. And you taught more great, not of the canon of great books, but you taught great American literature in the
what
ATNL.
What I taught was no contemporary literary. See, in the field of fiction, there is the, you know, the pop fiction.
Right.
And there is what they call literary fiction.
Mark Twain is literary fiction.
He would be literary.
Right.
But I taught contemporary, which means latest novels in the past, most of the things that I...
Smiley? Would she be...
Who, Jane Smiley?
Would she be considered that?
Yes.
More
I,
contemporary, but real literature.
It would be literary fiction, is what the term
is. Is Stephen King in that, or is he in pop?
No, I don't think he would make
right.
it.
Right, okay.
But you get the idea.
No, I get it. Yeah. So, did you do mysteries with Elmore Leonard in this? Pod?
No.
Okay.
No, I wouldn't consider that literary fiction.
Okay. So, just, I don't care the year or whatever, what are some of the books that you remember when you were teaching for ATL that you used,
well,
that you
we
liked?
Well, we did have, ATL went through a whole series of, you know, I taught there so many years that it kept changing,
right.
changing. But we had a basic text, which was, you know, a combination of the political history and literary history. There were texts, excellent texts for that kind of course.
Mm-hmm.
And I will say, I always believe that the course did more for the people teaching it than it did for the students, because all of them came from highly specialized fields where they got their doctorate.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to broaden themselves beyond their fields, so that if they majored in history, they had to learn about writing. They had to learn about literature in addition to history. If they came from the field of English, they had to acquaint themselves with history, so that they really became much broader in preparing for that course. So it's a combination of writing, history, and literary, American literary background.
So I'm going to give you a couple names of people I knew in that department.
Yeah. Oh.
Phil Korth.
Yes, I knew him.
Now, Phil, I knew some of what he taught. And some of what he did was he wrote articles about fishing and hunting. Did you know that? He is kind of a sidelight joke, but it was very good. You know, Field and Stream magazine?
Yeah.
For people.
Well,
he did that kind of thing, which was popular.
But you see, that would come under the category of writing. If it was serious writing, I don't know what, you know.
Some of those are fairly good. So I knew Phil, and then I knew him because he was involved in the attempts to unionize. He was active.
Yeah.
I also knew him because he and Bob Ripa shared hockey tickets.
Oh, really?
And when neither of them wanted to go, the Rivettes might get their tickets. And the team was so popular in the 80s, so successful, that it was hard to get tickets, and I'm a hockey fan.
I didn't know that.
But I also know Phil because much of what I did
overlap with what...
Because a lot of what I did was on the history, and part of how, I'm going to ask you about how and when you did oral history.
In some way connected with what went on in Flint. If I recall, did he?
He was interested in it, but his area, there were three major strikes before the Flint sit-down and before the UAW in 1934. One was in Toledo, called the Autolite Strike. One was in Minneapolis with the Teamsters, and then one was the longshoremen on the West Coast.
Oh.
Lash
went to the West Coast.
Went to the West Coast.
Longshoremen.
And wrote what I consider one of the best labor biographies ever on Harry Bridges. Phil wrote a book based on doing oral histories on the Toledo Autolite Strike of 34, and the Teamsters Minneapolis strike of 34. He also had a project on Michigan carpenters, which was oral history interviews with carpenters about the craft and their union.
Right.
And I was his fiscal agent for that project. It was a humanities council. And I was starting to do things on Detroit and Michigan labor history by interviewing people or having people that were associates of mine interviewing people. And I was involved in setting up a couple of these nonprofit 501c3s because the grant money was so small. If it went through the university, you take $10,000 and then you pull out some percent, it gets ridiculous.
I
so I just ran them as externals. And in the old days, you didn't get in trouble for that.
You knew who one of my students was, you know, because all freshmen had to take a course, was Jimmy Hoffett Jr.
I didn't know you had him. I've talked to him a couple times.
Have you?
Yes.
Well, he was just one of my students as a freshman, and I think it was around the time that his father had disappeared.
Wow. He came through here, and I can't remember how we... He also connected to the School of Labor Industrial Relations.
I'm not surprised.
Got his master's degree, I believe. And there was some event, or law, whatever.
Yeah.
We had some event that Curry was involved with, and I was there, and whatever. And after the event, the public part... A recent biography had been written about his dad, and I thought it was, there's tons of things written about Hoffa, just tons.
Oh,
about Hoffa and the mob, Hoffa and...
His mysterious death.
Right.
Has enough to keep that in the public eye.
But for somebody in labor relations, Hoffa was also interesting because in the 50s and 60s, until he went to jail, if you looked at Time magazine or Look or Life, you often saw George Meany, Walter Reuther, or Jimmy Hoffa. They were in the papers at all. If you lived in New York City, you might get Dave Dubinsky or a few other people. If in the West Coast or you're interested in longshore bridges. But for the vast majority of Americans, it really was Reuther and Meany and Hoffa.
I know.
And so it was just kind of fascinating. And this gentleman wrote a biography, which I thought was much better than most, because it helped explain why did the members like Hoffa. Because they didn't like him because he may have been connected to the mob or he may have done this or that. They liked him because he was delivering. He and the people he hired negotiated contracts that got these guys better jobs with better benefits and better pay.
Right.
And this person wrote a book, and I took it with me to this talk and asked James Hoffa Jr., what do you think about this one? And he said, I like it. I think it's better than most. It's fair. And so I was pleased to hear that, because I knew what I thought of it as a historian, but I wondered what the kid thought about the book about his dad. So, but he's fascinating. Of course, he's still there. And
I know it. And I have no sense of him at all. I mean, he was a freshman. He was on the football team.
I didn't know that. I've never interviewed him. I don't know if he did interview anybody at this point.
And I don't know anything about him. I mean, you know.
So, I asked you about Korth. Another person is Dot McMeekin, Dorothy.
She was in that side.
Right.
Yes, I know her, not well, but I know her.
She was in that kind of time period of yours.
Yes.
Okay.
And I've seen her more recently.
Okay.
Yeah.
She I got to know because she was part of this group that was active in the Faculty Associates Union effort. And I didn't know if you were socially connected with her then, but you weren't.
No,
I re-met
her. See, one of my students that I had 35 years ago now lives in East Lansing.
Oh.
And we're very good friends.
Great.
And Dorothy McMeekin was also one of her teachers.
Oh.
And so I re-met Dorothy through this student who I'm very close with.
Very nice. Another person I wanted to ask you was Gladys Beckwith.
Yes.
Now, Gladys did AT&L, correct?
She's what?
She was part of AT&L.
Oh, yes. She was AT&L, and I knew her from when I first started teaching there.
So did you have department meetings and you and somebody like Gladys or Phil or Doug Nover, would you talk about teaching techniques or what was working with the kids or not? Or
no, I don't remember doing that.
Okay.
I do remember at one point that our chairman at the time, and I forgot which chairman it was, mm-hmm. he hired Yellen. You know who Yellen is?
There's several Yellens, so I don't know what one you mean.
Steve Yellen?
Steve Yellen, yes. Okay.
And he was a consultant to improve teaching.
Yes.
So the chairman wanted people in our department to go to Yellen, perform for him. In other words, conduct a class under mm-hmm. his surveillance. Mm-hmm. And then get his feedback on how to improve their teaching.
Nice.
So the chairman made this association with Yellen, but no one in the department signed up for it, or hardly anyone.
Mm-hmm.
So the department chairman asked if I would be willing
oh.
to go to Yellen and let him, you know, watch my, what he did is televise the classroom situation. And I said, sure, I don't care.
Cool.
And he said, because the chairman felt that this would perhaps ease others into it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know whether it did or not, uh-huh. but I did do it.
Okay.
But that's the only time I remember anything said about teaching techniques.
Okay. I'm going to pause this. Just
Yellow.
But very
yeah,
similar.
It's the same.
But
the basic house, see, but your house has changed a whole
well,
lot.
Well, we did these before us, before Smucklers, in the 50s, there was a couple remodels that got done. And then the house we inherited had some problems because some of that was flat roof additions. So we had a lot of
oh.
mold and mildew
oh,
and
really?
Wetness problems. We then got carried away and redid the kitchen
oh.
and our master bedroom in significant ways.
Oh, I
and,
know.
And got rid of all the flat
and you
roof.
You have a basement.
Wick Court has basements, and
yeah.
pretty much only Wick Court for a while. Now there's a few more that do.
But see, we had this house, the basis. All the additions we made were out on the additions on the house, but the basic house we never changed.
Right.
So we added a bedroom.
Up front.
Up front. And we added a porch, and I added a little side entrance.
Mm-hmm.
Period. But this is the basic floor plan.
So another time I could ask you, but so who is the painting over the couch there?
That's me.
I thought it might be. Done when you were in the...
My father was a dentist.
Okay. In Brooklyn?
Well, his office was in Manhattan.
Okay. What was his name?
M. Gordon. My maiden name is Gordon. G-O-R-D-O-N.
Okay.
And he had, as one of his patients who had extensive dental work, an artist.
Are the good
one? Greenwich Village.
Okay.
The
what
artist
name?
Was a star. Huh?
What was the name again?
He came from Greenwich Village.
Oh, okay.
The art colony in Manhattan.
Okay.
And he was the literal starving artist.
Okay.
And he couldn't afford to pay his dental
mm-hmm.
bill. So he said, Mike, I'd like to paint your wife. And
nice.
My mother said, no, paint my daughter. And that was the dental bill.
So how old are you in the picture?
I think I must have been about